All right, I'd like you to take your Bibles this morning and turn to Romans chapter 8. When we do it God's way, He wants us to be the head and not the tail. In the next two messages, we're going to talk more about how and the kingdom will be ours once again.
Welcome to Mission to Israel, a broadcast ministry featuring author, teacher, and evangelist Ted R. Weiland. The focus of this ministry is to open the eyes of our people and give insight into the issues we find ourselves facing in this day and age. Our address is Mission to Israel, Post Office Box 248, Scotts Bluff, Nebraska 69363, or you can reach us via the web at www.missiontoisrael.org. And now, here is Ted Weiland.
This will be the Ninth Commandment, Part 2. I'd like you to take your Bibles this morning and turn to Proverbs chapter 2 to begin with. Proverbs chapter 2, we're going to begin with verse 1. It says, "My son, if thou wilt receive my words and hide my commandments with thee, so that thou shalt incline thine ear unto wisdom and apply thine heart to understanding. Yea, verse 3, yea, if thou criest after knowledge and liftest up thy voice for understanding. Verse 4, if thou seekest her as silver and searchest for her as for hid treasures, then shalt thou understand the fear of Yahweh and find the knowledge of God. For Yahweh giveth wisdom, out of his mouth cometh knowledge and understanding." If you'll recall, I concluded the introductory message to this series by praying that Yahweh would open up His Word to us concerning the Ninth Commandment. With that, bear in mind, though, that it's highly unlikely, with having prayed that prayer, that God's just going to somehow zap us with that understanding in answer to that prayer. It doesn't normally work that way. In fact, I've never seen him work that way, so don't expect that that's what's going to happen. We're going to have to do more than just pray for it. We're going to have to do as Solomon wrote to his boys. Incline our ear, apply our heart, and seek for it. In short, we've got to do some digging, some gold mining in the Word of God. If we're going to understand what, and especially because in this day and age we have lived for so long in such an antinomian society, both within and without the church, that we have gotten so far away from His laws and the understanding of even the Ten Commandments and all that they are, that we're going to have to do some digging and really get after it. All right, having said that, let's go to Deuteronomy chapter 5. We started in Exodus chapter 20, where, of course, the first time the commandments are enumerated, just before Joshua, just before Moses' death, just before Joshua is going to take the Israelites now after 40 years finally into the promised land, the Canaan land. Moses takes the opportunity before his death to essentially go over the law again, providing the Ten Commandments for the second time here in Deuteronomy chapter 5. And I guess I'd better get there, since I told you to get there. And there we'll see in the second giving of the law from Deuteronomy chapter 5 and verse 20, the ninth commandment as provided here. Deuteronomy chapter 5, still not there, excuse me, and verse 20. And it says, "Neither shalt thou bear false witness against thy neighbor." The Smiths were came from a proud family tradition. Their ancestors had come to America on the Mayflower. They had included many notable and very successful predecessors. And they decided to compel a family history, a legacy for their children and grandchildren, and so they hired an author. But there was one problem that they were very concerned over, and that was how to handle Great Uncle George, who was executed in an electric chair. They presented the problem to the author, and the author said, "Don't worry about it, I can handle it tactfully." The book appeared, it was published, and they all went searching to see what was going to be said about Uncle George. And the author had wrote the following, quote, "Great Uncle George occupied a chair of applied electronics at an important government institution. was attached to his position by the strongest of ties, and his death came as a great shock. End of quote. Now, I don't know if that can be depicted as a Ninth Commandment transgression, what the author wrote in that book, but I do know that some of the greatest biblical tragedies were the consequence of Ninth Commandment infractions. That is, quote-unquote, some of these were, in fact, tragedies, but some of them were just, quote-unquote, tragedies, understanding, of course, that all things work together for good to those who love God and to those who are called according to his purpose. But otherwise, tragedies. In light of that, we can understand things a little bit differently. But otherwise, still, some of the greatest tragedies in the Bible, and I'm sure I'm not going to enumerate even all of them, were the result of Ninth Commandment infractions. Joseph's brothers' lies to their fathers. That was a tragedy. Not only what they did to Joseph, but the fact that they followed it up with the lies they did for years to their brother, to their father. King Saul's, think about this one, King Saul's false testimony to himself about David and the consequences thereof. Doeg's deception to King Saul. David's false testimony concerning Uriah and Bathsheba. Jezebel's false witnesses against Naboth. Haman's lies to King Ahasuerus. The Persian prince's false testimony to King Darius regarding Daniel. And of course, the Pharisees' false witness and lies that eventuated in Yahshua's crucifixion. Tragedy after tragedy after tragedy, Old Testament and New Testament alike, as the consequence of transgressions of the Ninth Commandment in particular. No wonder in the list found in Proverbs chapter 6, enumerating the seven things that God hates most, that four out of the seven are infractions of the Ninth Commandment. I don't know if you've ever considered or seen that before, but consider. We won't turn there, but I'll read it to you. Proverbs chapter 6, verses 16 through 19. Listen, it says, six things doth Yahweh hate, yea, seven are an abomination unto him. A proud look, a lying tongue, and hands that shed innocent blood, a heart that deviseth wicked imaginations. In Matthew chapter 15, verses 18 and 19, it says, these things proceed from the heart, and one of those listed was a false testimony. So a lying tongue, a heart that devises wicked imaginations, feet that run swiftly to, feet that be swift and running to mischief, a false witness that speaketh lies, and he that soweth discord among brethren. You're going to sow discord among brethren? About the best way you can do it is to provide a false testimony. So four out of the seven things that God hates most are all at least associated with the Ninth Commandment in one fashion or another. In the first message, I pointed out how that each and every commandment is essentially, if you will, hadn't ever put it this way, but it's really what I was trying to explain, is that each and every commandment is a shell without, is essentially a shell without its statutes and its judgment that flesh it out, if you will. It's a shell in and by itself. It needs its statutes and its judgment to flesh it out and make it all that God intended it to be. Therefore, as with the previous commandments, we are going to study the Ninth Commandment via its statutes and judgments. And there may have been others that have approached it in this fashion, but I know of the Ten Commandments never. In all of the writings that I have and all the sermons that I've had preached on it, I've never seen it approached in this fashion. And I think it is the most important way to approach it. I mean, there's lots of good thoughts that you'll find in a lot of different books about the different commandments, but sometimes that's all they are, is just the thoughts of men. You do it this way, and we find out what God's idea, what his thoughts are concerning the Ninth Commandment, or any of the commandments, that is. But before we do so, I do want to spend some time, a little bit more time, on the commandment itself. Something I believe of some significance that probably most people are unaware of is that while the wording in the English in Exodus chapter 20:16 and Deuteronomy chapter 5 and verse 20 is nearly identical, there is a noteworthy difference in the Hebrew. The word false in both locations is translated from two different and unrelated words, at least unrelated linguistically. In Exodus chapter 20, false is translated from the Hebrew word sheker, and in Deuteronomy 5, false is translated from the Hebrew word shav. Sheker is defined by Strong's in the following fashion: as an untruth, by implication, a sham, end of quote, and by the Brown Driver Briggs Hebrew lexicon as, quote, a lie, a deception, a disappointment, a falsehood, end of quote. Sheker, that's the word that God inspired used in the first giving of the Ten Commandments when he came down, when Moses came down with the two tablets from Mount Sinai in Exodus chapter 20. And shav is defined by Strong's as, quote, in the sense of desolating, evil, what did I say something wrong? Evil, in the sense of desolating evil as, don't worry, I will. Quote, in the sense of desolating evil as destructive, literally ruin or morally, especially guile, figuratively idolatry as false, subjective, uselessness as deceptive, objective, also adverbially in vain, and by the Brown Driver Briggs Hebrew lexicon as emptiness, vanity, falsehood. Seems to even got worse, a little bit stronger with the second giving of the law, the word that God chose for Moses to use in that particular case. Kind of interesting that he did that, you know, that all of a sudden he gives these commandments the first time to Moses on Mount Sinai and uses one particular word and then has him the second time he writes them down to do it with a different word. Now, I can't say for sure why Yahweh inspired two different Hebrew words to express this commandment because he didn't tell us. But it stands to reason, and there may be more than this, and if others have other ideas on this that they can share with me after they've heard this, I'd be certainly willing to entertain them. But it certainly, at the very least, it stands to reason that he did so because those two words together provide a more comprehensive understanding of the and application of this commandment than they do in and by themselves. Now, for the purpose of perhaps better understanding this broader function based upon these two words, let me just briefly share with you just a few other passages that use these two words. Let's first begin with the word sheker. Again, it's found in Exodus 20:16, which is by definition an untruth, by implication, a sham, a deception, and even a fraud. It's also used in Exodus 23:7 in the simple statement that says, keep thee from a false matter. In Psalms 31:18, it's the Hebrew word translated lying. It says, let the lying lips be put to silence, which speak grievous things proudly and contemptuously against the righteous. In Proverbs 6 that we read earlier that enumerates the seven things that God hates most, sheker is found in both verse 17 and verse 19. It's lying in verse 17, a lying tongue, and it's the word false in verse 19, a false witness that speaketh lies, and he that soweth discord among brethren. It's also found in Proverbs 21 and verse 7. Amongst many of other places as well. I don't want to sound like these are the only locations it's found, but just some that I chose. Proverbs 21 in verse 7, it says, the bread of deceit, that's the word sheker, is sweet to a man, but afterward his mouth shall be filled with gravel. And then in Malachi 3 in verse 8, it says, and I will come near to you to judgment, and I will be a swift witness against the sorcerers and against the adulterers and against the false swearers. Sheker in Hebrew. Now, the Hebrew word shav, as found in Deuteronomy 5 and verse 20, and defined as emptiness, vanity, falsehood, and worthlessness, particularly centering on the word vanity or in vain, is also found, or at least initially centering on that, is also found used in Exodus 27 and Deuteronomy 5 and verse 11. Anybody know what's found there? In, thou shalt not take the name of Yahweh thy God in vain. That's the word shav. For Yahweh will not hold him guiltless that taketh his name in vain. It may give, you put the two together, take the Deuteronomy 5 rendition of the ninth commandment and kind of take that and maybe put it into the third commandment, and it may give us a little bit better understanding of the third commandment and what it means to take the the name of Yahweh in vain as well. But that's another matter. Also, in Exodus 23:1, we find it, thou shalt not raise a false report. Put not thy hand with the wicked to be an unrighteous witness. Psalms 12:2 has it as the word vanity. They speak vanity, every one with his neighbor, with flattering lips and with a double heart do they speak. Psalms 31:6, I have hated them that regard lying vanities, but I trust in Yahweh. And then in Proverbs 38 is another one. It says, remove far from me vanity and lies. Give me neither poverty nor riches. Feed me with the food convenient for me. There's two words there that could possibly be the word shav. Vanity and lies, which ones do you think it is? Now, with shav, you can bet it would be vanity, and of course, that is the word translated from shav. The word lies here is neither shav nor sheker, but is translated from another Hebrew word altogether, certainly related in the sense as to what it deals with. It's the Hebrew word kazab, and is most often just translated lies or lying. Now, those passages and others provide us with a little bit better feel. You know, it's, you can see the broad application of those words and how they're used, and how at least the King James and I'm sure other translations chose different English words, deception, lies, vanity, and a number of others, to express what those words mean. And hopefully they provide us with a little bit better feel and understanding of the intent of the ninth commandment. But still, even that only barely touches the surface of what needs to be considered, understood, and applied concerning this commandment, the ninth commandment. To do that, we need to examine the ninth commandment statutes. And so let's begin with the most obvious, false witnessing or false testimony against another in a court of law. Turn to Exodus 23, if you would. We find the commandment, of course, in Exodus chapter 20. Turn to Exodus chapter 23, and we'll find one of the statutes here for this commandment. Exodus 23, verses 1 and 2. It says, thou shalt not raise a false report, put not thy hand with the wicked to be an unrighteous witness. Thou shalt not follow a multitude to do evil, neither shalt thou speak in a cause to decline after many to wrest judgment. Now catch that, catch all that it says here. There's a lot stated herein. It says, thou shalt not raise a false report, put not thy hand with the wicked, another, to be an unrighteous witness. Thou shalt not follow a multitude to do evil, neither shalt thou speak in a cause to decline after many to wrest judgment. In other words, we are not to do it on our own, with someone else, or with a whole multitude of false accusers, the latter of which may be more of a problem with some people than being a false witness on their own. I think that there's probably some people who in and of themselves do not have an inclination toward being a false witness, but put them into a crowd of people that are all inclined to take one particular path against someone, and all of a sudden that person who by and in himself is not inclined to do so, all of a sudden finds himself following the crowd in doing so because of the peer pressure found therein. By the way, the latter, where it talks about not following a multitude and doing a crowd, pretty well describes, to do evil that is, that pretty well describes democracy, or at least where democracy usually ends up. It doesn't always begin, and it's not always evil in all that it does, but give it time, and I'll guarantee you that democracy is more bent toward evil as it continues down the road of its government actions than it is otherwise. Pretty much describes democracy or majority rule, which more often than not is simply mob rule. If for no other reason by the numbers, then by their numbers, they have the power to legislate as they will. And by the way, speaking of numbers and stupidity, someone recently shared with me one of their all-time great sayings, which is, you can't fix stupid. Now, you can fix ignorant. You can fix illiterate. But it's pretty tough most times to fix stupid, and especially the consequences thereof. And as it concerns stupid, some of you have also heard me warn before, never underestimate the power of stupid people in a large crowd, such as in a democracy, or regrettably, even in churches. In my experience, when compared with Yahweh's laws, the majority is invariably wrong and pretty often stupid, too, when compared with Yahweh's laws, both without and within the church, which shouldn't come as a big surprise to anyone since both of them are predominantly antinomian, at least in this day and age in which we find ourselves living today. You know, the song or verse that much of Christianity sings from time to time, though none go with me, is, listen, much more pertinent and applicable than what most people realize. Because it's not so tough to sing that song, or to even walk that road as most people see it, most Christians see it, when you've got most of Christianity backing you. But what about when the stand you take goes against the prevailing and popular trend of even most of Christianity? Though none go with me, still I will follow. Begin teaching Yahweh's laws, all of them, the whole counsel of God, and you'll find out what I'm talking about. You'll find out. You know, it's sometimes a very lonely road. Now, back to our principal point. This commandment regarding not bearing false witness is, I believe, of far greater importance than what I believe even many pronomians understand. Yahweh stresses its importance time and again. In fact, I was quite amazed as I started working on preparing messages for this particular series and looking up all the scriptures in the both Old and New Testament alike concerning this that would be relative to this commandment. I was amazed at how much there is. Some of the commandments, you know, there's a lot of power there in the statutes, but not near as many scriptures that repeatedly deal with the commandment or implications of the commandment in one fashion or another, near as much as what you'll find with the ninth commandment. Here in Exodus 23 that we just read, you know, he does so forcefully. Let me read it to you again. He says, thou shalt not raise a false report. Put not thy hand with the wicked to be an unrighteous witness. Thou shalt not follow a multitude to do evil, neither shalt thou speak in a cause to decline after many to rest judgment. All of that has to do with the ninth commandment. Other things too, but predominantly the ninth commandment. Now listen to me. When our progeny reestablishes Yahweh's kingdom here on earth as it is in heaven, and I'm looking forward to the day even if I'm not going to be here. But our progeny one day in the future reestablishes Yahweh's kingdom on the ruins of man's kingdom, which is sometime coming here in America and other places throughout the world, its viability, that of the kingdom, its viability and continued success will not only depend upon Yahweh's laws in general, but possibly more particularly, or most particularly, most specifically, upon establishing, and listen to me, a godly, God-ordained, if you will, righteous judicial system. And next in importance to justices who will enforce those laws is, I believe, the ninth commandment and all of its implications. Because justice in any particular case is predicated, relies not only upon magistrates who are truly honorable. Now let me take, just before I finish that thought, let me take a little side trail. Let me tell you what I mean by that. By that I mean judges who are loyal and resolute to the laws of Yahweh and exclusively to the laws of Yahweh. As described, for example, in Deuteronomy 1, 16 and 17, where it says, "And I charged your judges at that time, saying, hear the causes between your brethren, and judge righteously between every man and his brother and the stranger that is with him." Verse 17 in particular, he says, "You shall not respect persons in judgment, but you shall hear the small and the great, as well the small as well as the great, and you shall not be afraid of the face of man. For," here's the statement I want you to center in on, "for the judgment is God's, not yours. You're doing the work of God. You are judging according to his law, and therefore it's not even your judgment that you're rendering, it's his judgment." Contrast that who knows what, at any given time, what even the Supreme Court might come up with, because they're judging based upon man's decisions and not on God's. Like Deuteronomy 1, 16 and 17, what we find there again, "For the judgment is God's," like the judges set up, put into place by Jehoshaphat in 2 Chronicles 19. In fact, let's turn to this particular passage. 2 Chronicles chapter 19. And verses 5 and 7, where again we find judges being set up by Jehoshaphat after he got kind of set straight by Jehu and the seer or the prophet in verses 1 through 3. In fact, let's start there. It may give us a little bit, kind of sets the stage for Jehoshaphat getting the message and kind of putting things back in place here. In chapter 19, verse 1, it says, "And Jehoshaphat, the king of Joash, returned to his house in peace to Jerusalem." Where did he return from? Anybody know? Well, he just returned from an ungodly alliance with King Ahab. And you don't need to know much. Enough said just to say King Ahab, and put him and add Jezebel to it, and you know you've got about the worst king that ever sat the throne of the house of Israel. "And Jehoshaphat, the king of Judah, returned to his house in peace and to Jerusalem." Now, Jehu's a prophet. There isn't a lot about Jehu in the Bible, but let me tell you, he's a prophet and he's a godly man. You know, most men would just say, well, thankfully he's back and he's done with that. Not Jehu. Watch what he does. "And Jehu, the son of Hanani the seer, went out to meet him and said to King Jehoshaphat, shouldest thou help the ungodly and love them that hate Yahweh? Therefore is wrath upon thee before Yahweh." So that kind of sets the tone here, if you will. Jehu, the prophet, taking the king to task. You might say, well, why does he do that? You know, or, well, how dare him do that? Well, just like the judges who were to be impartial no matter what someone's stance in life was, the prophet or the preacher today is just to be just as impartial in what he preaches and teaches no matter who he does it to. And obviously Jehoshaphat was for the most part a good man. He got the message, and it leads right in from there into what we want to read in particular. That's right in line with Deuteronomy 1, 16 and 17, and it says, "And he said," Jehoshaphat, that is, verse 5, "and he set judges in the land throughout all the fenced cities of Judah, city by city, and said to the judges, take heed what you do, take heed what you do. Why? For ye judge not for man, but for Yahweh, who is with you in judgment. Wherefore now let the fear of Yahweh be upon you, take heed to and do it. For there is no iniquity with Yahweh our God, nor respect of purses, nor taking of gifts." In other words, he's not bribed, and you better not be bribed either, because what you're going to judge, it was the king's responsibility just as much as it was the people's to look to the fact that this is exactly what happened, that what you judge is not your own judgment, but you're judging on behalf of Yahweh. Their responsibility, the judges, as found in God's word, was to Yahweh and to Yahweh alone. For they judged on his behalf, otherwise they were nothing more than thugs with power. Like we have today. We got a bunch of thugs with power because they're not judging on God's behalf. And under this great democracy here in America, under this what's left of this constitutional government, they're not even judging on the people's behalf. They're just thugs with power doing as they wish. Now, back to the principal point, having established what I'm talking about when I'm talking about honorable judges. Back to the principal point. Justice in any particular case relies not only upon honorable, righteous, God-fearing judges who are true to God, but also let me start that statement again. Justice in any particular case relies not only upon honorable, God-fearing judges who are true and only true to the laws of Yahweh, but also upon the integrity of any witness provided therein. Because without trustworthy testimony, the judges will be unlikely to return or render righteous decisions. At least not all the time. And therefore, dependable testimony is not only imperative, it must be compulsory, and it must be enforced. Which is precisely where, not always been this way, but where the United States' current judicial system falls all apart. Oh, they make you swear to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. But today, in many instances, if you perjure yourself, there's really not much you have to worry about. Because the punishment will be minimal, if any at all. You know, you come into a case and you'd be a witness against somebody, and you falsely testify and they figure it out, they aren't going to do anything, for the most part. Occasionally, something may happen, but it completely falls apart. There, any justice therein based on the fact that that is allowed. It's no wonder that in addition to being humanistic courts, there's very little justice in our courts today. Now, no one can guarantee absolute truth in all cases. Yahweh can't even do that. You know, for no other reason, because court cases involve man against man and not God against God. You know, if it was God against God, he could guarantee it. But man is fallible. So nobody can guarantee it in all cases. But Yahweh has provided checks and balances pertaining to witnesses that I assure you, or that assure us, excuse me, of much more truthful testimony than anything that man has ever come up with. In fact, these checks and balances are the only thing that has any chance of us having predominantly truthful witnesses in our court cases. In fact, his checks and balances will keep the vast majority of dishonest cases and false witnesses from ever coming to litigation in the first place. Guaranteed. You see if you don't agree with me by the time we go through these. I've come up with six check and balances, more checks than balances, really, that Yahweh placed in his law to inhibit or curb false testimony in courts of law. And if after I've gone through these, if anyone here or those on the tape and CD ministry come up with additional ones that I haven't thought of or I didn't come up with in my study through the law that didn't come to mind, please let me know, because I'd like to know if there's ones I've missed. I'm always open to that kind of thing, additional information that I don't necessarily understand or things that I may present incorrectly at any given time that needs to be fine-tuned or completely thrown out the back window if need be. Now, although to my knowledge not found stated in the Pentateuch, I think you'll agree that the principle found in Proverbs chapter 24, which is where we want to go, is valid nonetheless. And should be used as one of these checks. Proverbs chapter 24 and the first part of verse 28. Proverbs 24, verse 28, it says, "Be not a witness against thy neighbor without cause." Without cause. Check and balance number one, or check number one, if you will. Frivolous cases, that is, either those not worthy of the court's time and attention, or those without merit from the onset, without cause, should be simply dismissed. Frivolous cases that have no merit. And you're going to get rid of probably a lot of bad cases and false testimony right off the bat. All right, with that in mind, check and balance number two. Or I should just call them checks, I think. Just check number two. That doesn't mean there's one in the mail. It just means check number two. An oath of Yahweh must be provided by all litigants. Now, I know there's people today who think, oh, the Bible teaches against oaths. That's just not the fact. That's a misrepresentation of certain passages in the New Testament that result from not taking the sum of God's word and putting it, summarizing it and bringing it all together so that we can understand God's will on the matter. And I think you'll see that as we go through these. Turn to Exodus chapter 22. An oath of Yahweh must be provided by all litigants. Exodus chapter 22, beginning with verse 10, it says, if a man deliver unto his neighbor an ass or an ox or a sheep or any beast to keep, and it die, or be hurt or driven away, no man seeing it, verse 11, then shall an oath of Yahweh be between them both, that he hath not put his hand unto his neighbor's goods, and the owner of it shall accept thereof, and he shall not make it good. Now, I think we can probably agree that this is certainly case law and not just simply an oath that was only required in instances like this particular one described here. That just doesn't seem to make sense, but that an oath would be required between different litigants that they would tell the truth in any particular case in their situation. Surely policy in all court cases. But someone may be wondering with that, well, how is that a check against false testimony? After all, for centuries, people have laid their hands on a Bible and sworn to tell the truth and then proceeded to lie through their teeth. Good point. Adam Clark commented upon these two verses and this issue in the following fashion. He says, quote, so solemn and awful were all appeals to God considered in those ancient times that it was taken for granted that man was innocent who could by an oath appeal to the omniscient God that he had not put his hand to his neighbor's goods. Since oaths have become multiplied, and since they have been administered on the most trifling occasions, their solemnity is gone and their importance little regarded. Should the oath ever require its weight and importance, it must be when administered only in cases of peculiar delicacy and difficulty and as sparingly as in the days of Moses, end of quote. Now, I agree and disagree with Clark in that statement. I disagree that such oaths were administered sparingly. I think it was far the opposite. But I agree that they were a solemn and awful appeal to God and that they were therefore taken very seriously in the cases when they were used and when they were employed and used in the biblical fashion. But Clark doesn't explain why they were solemn and awful. You know, they're not that just because somebody says they are, or they won't necessarily be solemn and awful just because somebody takes that oath. So why are they? Why would they be a solemn and awful thing? Awful used in the archaic sense of the word. Well, let's go back to the wording of Exodus 22:11. It describes it as an oath of Yahweh. Now, what do you suppose that was? An oath of Yahweh. Well, because it's not elaborated on in Exodus chapter 22, I believe it must be, then, what's described in Deuteronomy 6 and verse 13 and Deuteronomy 10 and verse 20 as an oath in the name of Yahweh, and thereby an oath of Yahweh. Deuteronomy 6:13 says, thou shalt fear Yahweh thy God and serve him, and thou shalt swear by his name. Now, again, some people get all hung up today on taking oaths. But the Bible, listen, does not teach against taking oaths. In fact, quite the opposite. And thou shalt swear by his name. Not by the name of other gods, but you shall swear by his name. and that God's people did take or make oaths in Yahweh's name, consider the oath that Abraham required of his servant. In Genesis 24 and verse 3, it says, "And I will make thee swear by Yahweh." I'm going to have you swear by Yahweh. I mean, they couldn't call on anybody else, couldn't make him, couldn't make the servant put him in any more trepidation in any other fashion by having him swear on anything else other than more than what would occur as a result of swearing by Yahweh. He says, "I will make thee swear by Yahweh." In other words, in his name. "The God of heaven and the God of the earth, and thou shalt not take a wife unto my son of the daughters of the Canaanites with whom I dwell." He says, "I'm going to make you swear to that in Yahweh's name." Now, what does the Bible teach regarding oath? What the Bible does teach regarding oaths is that we are not to make false oaths. Oaths, not to make them in the name of other gods, and when it's done in the name of Yahweh, that we're not to make false oaths in his name, and that we are required to fulfill those oaths. But again, who's to say that some uningenuous person or some unscrupulous scoundrel wouldn't employ Yahweh's name? It doesn't matter to him, in an oath to his own gain, and then turn around and lie through his teeth. Nothing. Who's to say, what's to say that some unscrupulous scoundrel won't do so? Nothing. But let's not forget that under Yahweh's law, that such would be a transgression of the third commandment. Leviticus 19 and verse 12, and it says, "And you shall not swear by the name of Yahweh falsely." Doesn't say you shall not swear by the name of Yahweh, but "thou shalt not swear by the name of Yahweh falsely, neither shalt thou profane the name of thy God, I am Yahweh." And note that swearing falsely in Yahweh's name is equivalent to profaning Yahweh's name, which is what? A third commandment transgression, is it not? And what's the penalty, the judgment, for knowingly and willfully transgressing the third commandment? Death. "And therefore, with this in play, at the judge's discretion, if he therefore deemed it a serious enough offense, he could so order that the perjurer, if caught, be put to death on that alone." Now, you think that wouldn't? That taking an oath is not a check? An oath in Yahweh's name is not a check against false perjurers? I'd think they're going to think twice. You know, I get caught in this. The judge may just so deem it that I be put to death on this alone. All right, the third check against false witnesses, not just capital cases, but every matter, is to be confirmed by the testimony of two or three witnesses. Turn to Deuteronomy chapter 19. Deuteronomy chapter 19 and verse 15, it says, "One witness shall not rise up against a man for any iniquity or for any sin, in any sin that he sinneth, at the mouth of two witnesses or at the mouth of three witnesses shall the matter be established." It's not just in capital cases that two or three witnesses or more are required, but in any matter taken to court, it requires two or more witnesses. In other words, if you're a false witness, here's the check. If you're a false witness with any hope of even getting to court, a biblical court, with your case, you're going to have to coerce or bribe someone else to be a false witness with you, because you got to have two. And therefore, to take the same chances at possibly being put to death for perjury, as you, if he gets caught, if the two of you get caught. I think it's going to probably eliminate a lot of false testimony in courts of laws. Looking pretty good. The fourth check is that judges are to make diligent inquiry of both, or are to make diligent inquiry of both litigants in all proceedings. Deuteronomy 19, picking it up in verse 16 again, it says, if a false witness rise up against any man to testify against him that which is wrong, then both the men between whom the controversy is shall stand before Yahweh, before the priest and the judges, which shall be in those days. Verse 18, and the judges shall make diligent inquisition. In other words, every man, particularly the accused, will have his day in court. He will be given the opportunity to defend himself against false accusations, giving the judge the opportunity then to determine, after diligent inquisition into both men, whether there's been false accusation on his account or not. Once again, knowing that is the case, and the other man has just as much a chance to convince the judge as I would if I was the false witness, I'm going to think twice about ever going before such a judge. Notice through all of this, too, there's no need for juries whatsoever in any of this. And you're going to see another reason why even a little bit further into this. Now, there's something else that I want you to note from this particular passage, and that is, that's often, I think, overlooked. Under Yahweh's law, every court case, both judges and priests presided. Not just judges, but judges and priests. And certainly not any juries. You don't need juries when you've got biblically qualified judges and priests, or their what would be their equivalent today, presiding over each and every case. Now, why do you suppose that it would be both judges, a judge and a priest, presiding over a case? It's actually another check and balance to assure justice. The judge's role is to administer or execute judgment for each and every case. He's to say, here's the judgment upon this person for whatever they're guilty of. Whereas the priest, or today the theologian, the expert, not just any theologian, but the expert in the law, his role would be to ensure that the proper judgment, according to Yahweh's law, is administered, not just any judgment, but that he's there to counsel the judge in anything he doesn't know. Now, the judge needs to be obviously educated in the law as well, but the priest, the Levite, the theologian, expert in Yahweh's laws, is there as a check and balance for the judge to make sure that he's applying the right law, the right statute, and the right judgment to whoever it is, that everything is done according to the law of Yahweh in that court case. And again, it's just another check and balance. And so much, by the way, so much for the idea of this idea of separation of church and state. Listen, it was never, never Yahweh's intent for the two to be separate, but instead that the church, that is his, the laws, which of course not always, there are not always one and the same, especially in this day, but that the church, when representing his law, not be separate from the state, but permeate and saturate the state. In fact, that there be no state except that which, if you will, the church. Or stated better, because the word church today does not mean what the Greek word ekklesia means, but except the ekklesia, or the ecclesia, if you prefer. That is what the state is, the ecclesia of the New Testament when it's understood correctly. All right, moving on. The fifth check. Witnesses must be prepared to help dispense judgment, particularly in capital cases. Deuteronomy, jump back to Deuteronomy chapter 17. And read with me verses 5 through 7. It says, then thou shalt bring forth that man or that woman which have committed that wicked thing unto thy gates, even that man or that woman, and shall stone them with stones till they die. Verse 6, at the mouth of two witnesses or three witnesses shall he that is worthy of death be put to death, but at the mouth of one witness he shall not be put to death. Verse 7 in particular, the hands of the witnesses shall be first upon him to put him to death, and afterward the hands of all the people, so thou shalt put evil away from among you. Now, it says that the hands of the witnesses shall be the first upon him to put him to death. Now, there's also indication that the first also to throw some of the first stones would also be the next of kin or the victim themselves in capital cases. But along with the victim or the victim's next of kin, the witnesses were required. It wasn't optional. They were required to take some of the first stones and put this man to death. So, you know, you've got to be pretty convinced. If you're a good man and you're not a scoundrel, you've got to be pretty well convinced that this guy's guilty, that your witness is true, because you're going to have to actually put them to death. Now, this one in and of itself wouldn't necessarily get rid of a lot of false witnesses, but it would make some think. Take second thought, you know, am I willing to falsely testify enough so that I'm going to put this guy to death? Especially knowing if I get caught in this, what the outcome is going to be, which is what we're going to get to next. The sixth check, and arguably probably the most significant, is Yahweh's prescribed judgment for false accusers. In Proverbs 19 and verse 5, it says, a false witness shall not be unpunished. He goes on, he makes it even stronger, and he says, and he that speaketh lies shall not escape. You're not to let it get by. Those who are false witnesses against others and liars, they're not to go unpunished. You know, something for us to think about today. Let me tell you, there is so much false accusations today. And God says, you know, you just don't let that go by. It needs to be punished. But more important than that general statement in Proverbs chapter 19, general statement of punishment, is the specific punishment against false accusers, which is also found in Deuteronomy chapter 19 in the same passage, again picking it with verse 16 and reading to the end. It says, if a false witness rise up against any man to testify against him that which is wrong, then both the men between whom the controversy is shall stand before Yahweh, before the priest and the judges that shall be in those days. Oh, by the way, not only did judges, a judge and a priest reside over each and every case. Don't miss. So did Yahweh. Look at it again. It says, then both of the men between whom the controversy is shall stand before Yahweh. How do you know that? Well, when you got a judge and a priest there that's abiding only by the word of God, the laws of God, you know you're under Yahweh's jurisdiction. Before the priest and the judges, which shall be in those days, and the judges shall make diligent inquisition, and behold, if the witness be a false witness and has testified falsely against his brother, verse 19, then shall you do unto him, listen carefully, then you shall do unto him as he had thought to have done unto his brother. So shall thou put the evil away from among you. Brand new thought. So shall thou put the evil away from among you. You know, that gives new meaning to the phrase in the Lord's Prayer where it says, deliver us from evil. I think that's what it's talking about. God is saying it's the prayer is about his kingdom here on earth as it is in heaven. And he's saying, deliver us from evil. Particularly, it's not even evil. We think of deliver us from our own sin. It's talking about deliver. The word is deliver us from an evil one. Deliver us from an evil one. How do you deliver us from the evil one? You apply God's judgments in his kingdom to those who are not willing to follow their God and who transgress his commandments. And so you'll deliver the evil from among you. How? You do unto them, in this case the false witness, what he had planned to have caused to do unto the one he's falsely testifying against. Going on, verse 20, and those which remain shall hear and fear and shall henceforth commit no more such evil among you. You think God, you think this check and all the other checks don't have an effect? He says, listen, you do this. Do just this one. And everyone else is going to hear, they're going to see, they're going to know about it, and they aren't going to do it again. They aren't going to be a false testifier again. Occasionally, you may have to remind them. You know, occasionally somebody's going to come up and be a false testifier. It's false witness. And you're going to have to do unto him just like he intended to do unto the others. And then there will be a lot of fear and people won't want to ever do it again. Verse 21, and very important, thine eye shall not pity. Do it, he says. But life shall go for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, and foot for foot. Whatever it is he intended for you, he gets it, even unto death. And of course, he's already worthy of death because he broke the third commandment. That's the law of lex talionis, life for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth. And you talk about an effective means of getting, assuring that we have very few false witnesses in our courts of law, that we have dependable, trustworthy, and truthful witnesses in every case to ensure, along with the judges and the priests to preside over the case, to ensure that we have justice in our courts like they could only dream about having in the system we have today. Furthermore, apply this judgment in just instances of life for damages from someone and from the multitudes of false accusers today in one regard or another, and there would be far less slander, far less defamation of character. Goodbye today's media as well. It's gone, at least as it functions today. And it's something that we should teach our children. It's something I taught my children from the earliest, from very early in their very early ages, that, listen, you testify against one of your brothers or sisters falsely and you get caught, you're paying the penalty. You're going in the back room instead of him or her. Teach it. It's a great way to teach God's law to our children. Now, I guarantee you that unlike today's courts where little justice can be found, apply these checks and balances, and especially this last one, and there will be next to no one who would even consider being a false accuser in a court of law against someone else. Now, I hope you can already see, we just barely have got into the Ninth Commandment, but I hope you can already see just how important the Ninth Commandment is. And we're going to deal with it on a personal level as well. This is more on a governmental situation. But this alone should certainly demonstrate just how important the Ninth Commandment is. And once again, how perfect Yahweh's laws truly are, especially when compared to our lousy laws and justice. Quote, you know, it's injustice to even, it's criminal to even call it a justice system. But it should illustrate just again how perfect his laws are and how imbecilic and even criminal today's Christians are who want to dispose of it. It's not just imbecilic, it's criminal. Because it's because we don't have his law, because of antinomian preachers today, why we have so much injustice in this land today. And it's only going to get worse. May God help us to wake them up. May we be awakened to more understanding of this commandment and all of his laws and its application for our lives and the laws of, and the lives of our nation as a whole. Let's pray. Heavenly Father, we're thankful, Lord, to you again for your word and all that it contains. We're thankful for this commandment, Father, that we've already begun to see how very, very important it is, that it's just not one of those added and tacked on to the end, but that it's extremely important for us to ever have justice in this land again in the future. And also, Father, for what it requires of us individually, for us to do our very best, that we not slander or backbite, that we not falsely accuse another brother to someone else. We ask this, Father, that you'd open our eyes again to more and more truth, that you'd guide me in presenting this material, that it would be useful, Father, for, first of all, glory to you and useful for your kingdom, but useful for us as well in reestablishing that kingdom here on earth someday in the future. We praise you and we thank you for it. And we ask it in Yahshua the Christ. Amen.